about the background of personal computer history, but primarily I want to focus on some of the things that will be happening over the next 4 or 5 years that are going to change the ways software and PCs are used. By a hobbyist, the type of people who put together radios. These people really did know what software was at all. In fact, the company who sold these machines had themselves only put one or two together, and after they got them put together, they really didn't know what to do with it. The only way you could program this machine was use the front panel there, where you could key in binary codes, and then your output was simply by causing patterns to appear in the lights. And so when Paul and I actually wrote this basic interpreter for this machine, it went down to the company. They, for the very first time, put 4K memory into one of these machines and hooked up a teletype, and we actually ran our Altair BASIC on that machine. We actually never used the real chip before. What we did was we took the manual for the instruction set and we wrote a simulator on the PDP-10. But that PDP-10, which is no longer used at all, was sort of the machine that a lot of people who were involved with computers grew up on in those days. And our technique was to take the source code of the macroassembler and the debugger and modify those to understand this 8080 instruction set. Well, we were a little worried that this thing would work because if we'd read anything wrong in the manual about the condition codes or the opcodes or any of those things, we would get out to this company and plug in this paper tape and nothing would work. So we spent all night the night before just making sure we had no errors. But still, it was pretty stunning to see it actually run the first time, because it ran 10 times as fast on the real machine as on the simulator we created on this PDP-10. In any case, this was the start of the PC revolution. Over 10,000 of these kits were sold. Some of the people probably never successfully put them together. A lot of people called up after they got them together and couldn't get it to do anything and wondered why. We had to tell them that they forgot to buy memory to stick into the box. The memory card was 256 bytes of memory, and so I created a software library of sort of games that you played in the lights. One of the big advances we made was when we realized that the unterminated bus of this machine created so much noise that the RF actually allowed you to play music through a radio. And we came up with some very interesting techniques where, depending on the instruction patterns that would be executed, you could actually cause it to generate reasonable music. So that was a very popular output device. The early personal computers were based on what we call 8-bit microprocessors. There's actually quite a variety of instruction sets, 6502, 6800, 6809, 8080Z8 family. Paul and I wrote this Microsoft BASIC for all those different machines. And every manufacturer's machine was different. In fact, the first 13 companies that licensed our BASIC all went out of business very quickly. It was a very volatile business at the time. And then a few came along, companies like Commodore and Radio Shack, that were very committed. And Apple came a little bit later and built their machine. These machines started in this time frame, 76, 77, 78, to have visual terminals connected and to use floppy disks for the exchange of data. For a while we used the audio cassette tape, but the data rate and reliability of that was simply inadequate to do any sort of serious applications. And so once we got the reliability of floppy disks up, then the industry could really take off and move to a different breed of application than just people hacking around doing patterns and the likes. So from 1977 until 1980 was this 8-bit era. And the only common element of the machines at that time was the fact that we managed to convince all of the manufacturers to build Microsoft BASIC in, so you could exchange programs at the BASIC level. But we had realized a couple of things. First was we decided that instead of having all the programs be interchanged at BASIC, we decided we wanted to exchange them at a machine code level. And we decided that this 8-bit architecture that limited the memory space to 64K simply wasn't adequate for the applications that we wanted to support. And so we wanted to move the industry up away from 8-bit up to 16-bit computers. In fact, we felt that if we created a binary standard around 16-bit computers, that the sharing of software you could get on all those machines would be an incredible thing. The history of the software ideas like symbolic debugging and profiling. People would talk about that stuff, but if you really looked at what engineers had as tools in those days, they'd include that stuff because there was never time to get around to perfecting those tools before a new generation of hardware would come along and you would simply recreate the very low-level software tools that you'd been working with. That made sense when hardware was so expensive, but as the cost of creating software and the need to create a large variety of software came to dominate the computer industry, that duplication simply wasn't going to make sense. And so it was in 1981 that, well, it's actually 1980, we convinced IBM, who came to us, to build a machine around a 16-bit microcomputer. Actually, this group that came to us from IBM was kind of unusual. It was a very small group. Their goal was not to build a great personal computer or anything. Their goal was actually to prove that a project could be done inside IBM in less than 2 years' time. That's quite serious, I'm not kidding. And it was actually as an afterthought that they thought, okay, build a low-end computer, that'll be a nice thing to prove out these methodologies. There were two competing teams inside IBM. One was called Project Go, and that was a team that went to a Japanese company, Matsushita, and had them build a computer for them. The other was the team down in Boca Raton called Project Chess, and they decided to work directly with Intel on the microprocessor and with Microsoft on the software to put together a machine. It's kind of unusual for us because Matsushita turned around and bought the software from us. So unbeknownst to IBM, we were actually supplying the software for both the competitive sides of this project. The idea was to get it done quickly, and so their initial design that they came to us with was an 8-bit design. Fortunately, one of the key engineers there, a guy named Lou Egerberg, was very open-minded, and we convinced him that in order to do anything unique, they needed to take some risk and be one of the first to come out with a 16-bit machine. So this machine, based on the 8088, using an operating system we created called MS-DOS, was the first of that generation of machines, and it shipped in October 1981. Well, subsequent to the release of this machine, something really amazing happened to the computer industry. In 1981, every computer company in the world had their own desktop design, and they varied very wildly. The graphics, the disk, the microprocessor, all of the structure was quite different. And there were a great number of proud companies that had their best engineers work on these desktop designs. HP, Wang, TI, all the Japanese, NEC, Toshiba, Fujitsu, the European companies, Nixdorf, Olivetti, Siemens. And they were all doing it their own way. Well, subsequent to IBM coming out with their machine, a few companies, including a startup little company down in Texas called Compaq Computer, and one or two others decided to build machines that were exactly the same. Well, we knew that this would create something interesting where there could be a lot of software variety available for this one machine. But even we underestimated how quickly this would sweep the designs of desktop machines. Between 1981 and 1984, literally every computer company in the world, except Apple, who we'll come to later, switched their designs and gave up having a proprietary design and followed the design that we had done for IBM. The reason that that happened was a very interesting phenomenon. As new software companies got started to develop applications for these low-cost machines, they had a choice of what machine to write their software for. Well, of course, they decided initially to choose the most popular machine to do all their development and testing. And this fairly quickly was the IBM PC design. So they'd write their little software package, and once they finished it, they'd say, well, geez, you know, what machine shall we do the new version for? And sometimes they'd decide to update that version immediately before going off and porting to all these other machines. Well, that meant for users, when they were looking at individual machines, the one that they'd find the most applications for would be this certain design. And so, of course, that meant that more of those machines would sell, which meant that more software companies would decide to focus on only that design. Well, this sort of self-reinforcing behavior leads to exponential results, which is certainly what we saw in this case. The design of that machine, developed by 1984, an installed base of over 3 million machines. Of course, worldwide today, we've already passed 30 million machines of that design. And if you understand the economics of the software industry, it has a pretty dramatic impact. Developing software is basically a fixed cost operation. Duplicating the disks and manuals is not very expensive. And so the fact that you have a potential base of 30 million users allows you to develop very obscure applications like, say, mortuary management on a very profitable basis. Even if, you know, 0.1% of those users own mortuaries of a certain size, you can probably recover your costs and sell the program at a very reasonable price. And, of course, that means that more people buy those personal computers. And so 1981 really led to the creation of the software industry. Today, the vast majority, over 80% of software sales, take place on these standardized desktop machines available from over 300 manufacturers worldwide. You have incredible choice when you buy these machines. They can be portables, there's a range of speed, a range of memory and disks. But because you have so many companies competing and so much volume, you can view the amount of effort it takes to take the latest Intel chip, stick it with the latest Microsoft software, put it into a box with a display and a mouse and a keyboard. You can view that as an extremely efficient, almost commodity-like process that takes whatever level of performance it is that Intel is offering and makes that widely available to the world. And so that sort of, any machine that's less powerful than that is not interesting. It just shouldn't be done because it won't have the same wealth of software that machine has. And so that increase in power of the standard Intel microprocessor, which is moving very quickly, and I'll talk about specifically, is in the process of completely transforming the computer industry. In fact, this move away from these integrated companies like IBM and Dell, they used to do their own architectures and their own operating systems, to a world in which operating systems are standard, and software is done by the software industry, and chips are done by the semiconductor industry, is a total revolution in the computer business. And it's interesting to look at how the established companies are going to adapt to this new order. The basic summary is that most computer companies won't adapt to this new order because it's such a fundamental shift. And the decision that Paul and I made, when we started the company, focusing only on software really makes sense only in light of the view we had that systems companies wouldn't be able to command a great deal of profit. In fact, it was one of the few debates that Paul and I ever had. He was more of a hardware person. He knew how to stick that stuff together. And when he had lab courses, he'd go to the lab and things like that. I prefer things that, you know, they may be hard to get them working, but once they work, boy, they're done. They stay working forever after. And so it's really my argument that software was where we belonged, and that commoditizing these hardware standards was something that we, as a company that wasn't supplying hardware, could do by providing these designs to hardware manufacturers like the Japanese, IBM, and others, and influencing the semiconductor companies to do the right thing. Well, that's led to a very impressive, or very important partnership between ourselves and Intel Corporation in building these microprocessors. The basic vision that drives all this is that as these machines get to be very low cost, and as we live in a society, which they say is in the information age, where there's an increasing amount of data out there that you want to transform into knowledge or real information, it's going to require a device like this to help people communicate, to help them make good decisions at the pace that business decision-making moves at. So it was actually at the very start of the company in 1975 that we wrote down a few key things about what we wanted to do with our company. The first was that we felt there would be a personal computer on every desk and every home, and that we wanted to set the software standards for that. Another key element, the second thing we wrote down, I'll talk a little So it's a 1 megabyte address space. And in that original design, I took the upper 384K and decided a certain amount should be for video memory, a certain amount for the ROM I/O. And that left 640K for general purpose memory. And so that leads to today's situation where people talk about the 640K barrier, the limit of how much memory you can put to these machines. I have to say that in 1981, making those decisions, I felt like I was providing enough freedom for 10 years. That is, a move from 64K to 640K felt like something that would last a great deal of time. Well, it didn't. It took about only 6 years before people started to see that as a real problem. Fortunately, there is a reasonable solution to this, which is that as Intel has moved forward with its chip families, the 286 chip that you find inside the AT introduced in 1984 moves up to a 24-bit address by treating the second register through a level of indirection. It's actually not that good. So that's sort of an intermediate milestone, you'd have to say. But in 1986, we moved up to what's called the 386, where we get a full 32-bit offset to the even those segments that have been designed in this architecture. So we have this machine that can address 4 gigabytes of memory. And I have to say, with all honesty, I believe that it'll take us more than 10 years to use up that address space. And so essentially, we're on very strong architectural ground. That is future wraps of the chip. Yes, they'll add a few clever instructions, make certain things fast, and yes, they'll add some things that have to do with multiple chips and all that. But the basic thing you'll see is that the architecture will stay the same, and it'll simply be improvements to the implementation that allow this chip to run dramatically faster than it runs today. Of course, this amount of memory is actually greater than the large mainframes that are available. IBM's mainframes actually give you 2 gigabytes because they're 31 bits of address space. So we've reached the frontiers of computer capabilities there. In terms of performance, we are still somewhat behind, not as much as you'd think. The 386 today, which machine can go out to any computer dealer by running at 25 megahertz, delivers about 5 million instructions per second. And 5 MIPS is greater than all but the very high end of the DECVAX computer line. This is in our rate of improvement is much greater than any computers or mainframes. In fact, in a few months, you'll see us move up to 33 megahertz. That's a 25% kick. By the end of this year, the next generation of the 386 architecture will be introduced. Now it gives about a 2.4 times improvement over the 33 megahertz 386. So that will take us up to about 12 MIPS of speed in uniprocessor performance. What you've seen us happen at the micro level is we take everything that they've done in large machine architectures, whether it's paging, simplification of the instruction set, any of those things, we move it down to the PC level. There's one trick that we haven't taken yet, and we'll only take in a limited way. That's the idea of using multiple processors. When somebody says to you, hey, a 3090 is a fast machine, they're generally talking about a 3090 mod 600 where you have 6 processors. And for commercial type applications running mainframes, splitting it down so you use these multiple processors works pretty well. That also works very well for what we call a departmental server in a networking situation because you're dealing with multiple. It doesn't work quite as well, given the current state of computer science, for a workstation for the individual's PC. And so for the foreseeable future, an individual's PC will be in a processor. But these servers that will sit out in the network will be multiple processors. So for those machines, we'll actually get more of a kick in performance than even just the improvements in the individual chips. We'll also get about a factor of 10 that comes from clever use of the multiple chips and the right software designed around those things. So we're moving very quickly to get all the speed. In fact, it's fair to say that the software industry will have to be very clever to figure out how to use this speed. Actually, even this 386 architecture won't be the fastest around. There's a variety of so-called RISC architectures that will run some interesting to ask is, given a workstation that runs at 30, 40, 50 MIPS, what type of software is there that's relevant to a typical office worker that would make their job easier or better that we could put on there? And that's a several-million-dollar question that if you can solve it properly, you get to have a large software company. And so there's a lot of clever people thinking along those lines. Well, just as a brief aside, Microsoft has been involved in a lot of key milestones in this industry, whether it's the PC or desktop computing or the creation of the Macintosh or now the move up to more advanced operating systems, certain networking standards, advances in the development tools, which is now very focused on techniques relating to object-oriented programming. We've tended to grow pretty much with the industry. We have now about just under 500 software engineers who are split onto projects so that, with the exception of one project, there's less than 10 people involved in any particular product. That's sort of the attention we have to how we keep those teams efficient is really one of the key assets the company has. No individual product we have, whether it's DOS or Excel or Word or any of that, really is that valuable, because 2 or 3 years from now, who cares? Software will be so much better that an individual product like that won't sell. So the real key in our business is being able to do things efficiently, being able to move very quickly. And it's not a matter of scale. It's not a matter of throwing a lot of programmers onto something. It's a matter of throwing the right 10 people or less on individual projects. And it turns out it's very tricky, perhaps impossible, for a company that isn't focused on software to do a very good job of this. For example, companies like IBM are struggling with the idea of, geez, how do they write good software? And I personally am not very optimistic that large organizations like that will ever learn how to write great software. And they'll certainly try very, very hard. Well, in the area of hardware, as I've discussed, the microprocessor is giving us a fundamental improvement that it's going along with great pace. There's other elements of the hardware that are really important. The idea of higher graphical resolution is very important. When we talk about graphics, of course, what we're talking about is the ability to treat the display as a set of individual points and independently control whether those points are on and off. And when we look at the grid that those points are on and talk about how fine that grid is, that's the idea of resolution. The original PC, actually the original IBM design IBM showed us had the graphics in it, but the design we ended up with had fairly low resolution graphics. The grid was 640 in the horizontal direction and 200 in the vertical direction. And that typically today would be considered low resolution graphics. We moved up over the years through a set of designs to what we now call VGA, where the X horizontal is the same, 640, but now the Y direction we have 480 grid lines. And that gives us a very nice resolution on a 12-inch display that's about 60 dots per inch. We'd like to move up to more like 120 dots per inch, but tubes are very expensive. And we can actually do an extremely good job at our current level. The 640 by 480, coincidentally, on the PC architecture is actually identical to the resolution that you find in a Mac 2. Of course, depending on the implementation, the pixel depth, that is, the number of colors and shades that an individual dot can assume, varies quite a bit from one pixel where it's just on and off, for example, like in a Macintosh SE, to things like the Mac 2, where you have 8 bits per pixel and can do 256 colors, to much more advanced graphics hardware where 24-bit, even 32 bits per pixel allow you to render images that are so realistic that even the human eye can't tell the differences between shading and those bits per pixel. We're constantly improving this because visualization is a key to allowing the computer improvements that we made to the machine include letting more data get in and out of the machine at a high speed. We often talk about a balance in a computer design. It has to do with making sure that if the processor is going to run super fast, that you also have enough memory to keep the processor going and high-speed enough disk that you're not sitting there waiting all the time for the disk. And so the incredible improvements in the microprocessor really put demands on other parts of the system. Fortunately, some of those other parts, like graphics, the processor, floating point, even memory, are also semiconductor technologies that are generally on the same learning curve, same improvement curve. However, there has been a three-year period here where the price of memory has essentially stayed on a plateau. And that's bad. It's the result of a number of factors, including the U.S. government, and the transition to 1 megabyte chips, and underestimating industry demand. The good news is that within the next 9 months, certainly within the next 18 months, but I'm optimistic enough to believe in the next 9 months, we'll get back to the point where the price of memory is dropping at the 30% a year that it has been historically. In fact, we have some rather dramatic drops we can make right away as soon as supply outstrips demand. And so there will be no problem balancing the memory. There's sometimes a rule of thumb that you like to have about a megabyte of memory for every bit of speed that your machine has. So that means this 5-bit machine, you'd really like to have 4 or 5 megabytes. It means that 15-bit machine, you'd like to have at least 32 megabytes in there. The reason I say that is that otherwise, you run the instructions so fast that you end up having to go to the disk to get the next instructions, and you waste all that performance sitting around waiting for the disk. Likewise, disk performance will be going up at similar costs. So it doesn't look like any element of the system will be getting out of phase in order to create these low-cost, very high-performance systems. Our role in this is to advise system manufacturers how to develop these systems. We have stayed pretty true to the motto of only doing software, although we deviated to do this little mouse device that you see in the lower left there. We were having a hard time convincing manufacturers that a mouse was a good thing. In fact, even today, there's a lot of users who never used a mouse who think, geez, you know, what an awful thing to be, you know, shoving something around on a desk. You really have to, it's hard to describe why it's a good idea. You just have to get people to use it, and then they discover, oh, hand-eye coordination, that's how I walk around every day. So it ends up being a very natural thing. I actually sold at this stage about 1.5 million of those mice. And today on PCs, about 25% of the machines are equipped with a pointing device. Of course, over the next 3 or 4 years, that should change to be about 100%. The other area that we participated in and had a very strong role is in this area of system software. The original operating system we wrote for the PC, it was a very simple operating system. It was appropriate for those days. A lot of those machines only had 64K, and everything about the operating system matched that design point. It ran only one application at a time. It ran only in the 640K. Even the file system was one that I designed to take a very limited amount of code and essentially deal with situations where you had up to about, let's say, 10,000 different allocation units on the disk, which works pretty well up to 20 megabyte to 40 megabyte type disk. Well, so even that disk structure is now inappropriate for some of the higher-end PCs, and we need to make a change. The idea of running only one application is a very damning thing. It prevents us from using the philosophy that we really need in software design. That is, instead of building a specific tool to do exactly one task, what we want to do is build a lot of little tools and then let somebody come along and assemble them together in a certain way to get exactly the solution that they want to build. It's far less expensive to do it that way because you get, right after, philosophy that actually is sort of Kermit's idea that everybody involved was pretty enthused about, was evidenced through the use of pipes. That is, you could take individual things and tie them together and have a serial stream pass between them. Well, that paradigm of using a serial stream, it works for a certain set of things. Actually, the thing it works best for is when programmers hacking around building the tools for themselves. But it's not rich enough to deal with, for example, user interface customization, to deal with commercial applications. So actually the ideas that a lot of people are pursuing on really are a very high priority for us. Building the code in the system to be what's called object-oriented is a very nice generalization of that idea. The idea is that instead of any piece of code, well, in today's world, if you write a piece of code and you're going to pass it some data to manipulate, that code intimately knows exactly how that data is structured. And so you have built into the programs you write all the limitation that if they know about graphs, fine. If they don't, they're never processed them. If they know about certain type of funny bitmaps, fine. But otherwise, you're going to have to go get your source code metadata to process those things. The change that takes place in an object-oriented design is that because data is passed with a level of indirection, that is with code classes associated with it, to perform these operations, it's not necessary that a program understand all the information that it's dealing with. It can simply understand the operations it wants to perform on those operations. And, you know, it's a nice thing from a pure computer science point of view. It actually is very dramatic in terms of allowing customizability of applications and has a great impact, particularly in this visual world where we want users to be able to sit down and pull little pieces together and essentially assemble an application without knowledge of programming languages. In any case, this MS-DOS operating system has served us very well. And in fact, it's going to continue to go on selling and be an incredible standard. Particularly as you look at DOS machines getting down to the $400, $500 price point, it's fair to say that it'll move into the home productivity and educational marketplaces in a very big way. However, it's not a strong enough foundation for the years ahead. What we really want is an operating system that gives us all this compatibility we've had with DOS, and yet gives us some of the rich operations that applications are going to expect. Now, the philosophy in developing a new operating system has got to be that instead of taking one little step one year and another little step the next year, you have to really look out ahead, and although it's difficult to do, try and create an operating system that will be strong enough to be the foundation for the next, say, 8 to 10 years. And that's exactly what we're doing in moving forward to this operating system we call OS2 that we have put into the marketplace fairly recently and continues to be our top priority in terms of system software design. An operating system requires an incredible number of pieces. Networking, presentation management is the name for the windowing system that deals with all the input devices like mice and keyboards and the coordination of multiple applications sharing the screen and moving data between each other. The file systems, utilities. The area of networking that I'll talk about has become an area that demands as much software as the rest of the operating system put together. And when you ship one of these operating systems, unless you have all these great development tools, it really doesn't prove anything because an operating system is such an internal thing that end users aren't ever interested in it. They're only interested in the applications, the unique applications that run on top of that system. And so, to start up a new generation is a fairly immense effort that we're now undertaking. OS2, of course, gets rid of the trivial limitations. It gets rid of the 640K and gives you the full 32-bit address space. It does real multitasking. It actually does it in a fairly nice way. In the original multitasking systems, there was this notion of virtualization, that each task would essentially see an entire machine, and the before you have decided which piece of your program should run at any time. Of course, once you get to that stage, you have that synchronization primitives and a great number of things that have been around. But a realization that I'd say only became widespread within the last 4 or 5 years is that these tasks, the original way they were designed, carried with them a lot of overhead in switching between tasks. That is, each task had its own I/O state and its own memory state. And you really weren't going to be able to write great programs if you continue to have the notion of the entity that carried all the state with it and the entity that got scheduled being the same. So a nice improvement, which is allowing individual tasks to have multiple scheduling entities called threads, or in some cases, lightweight processes. There's a lot of terminology in the industry. In the case of OS2, it's called threads. But that was a very important thing to allow people to write simple programs. The beauty of having something like this is that it encourages people to express the parallelism in their programs, which means that when those programs are run on a unit processor design, fine, we're scheduling one resource, it works. But when we run that program on a multiprocessor design, we understand exactly how to take advantage of the multiple execution units. And so when you have operating systems without a primitive like that, you end up with code that's structured in a way that really can never take advantage of multiple processors. There's other things in this system that are fairly important. In today's operating systems, you get, when you want to create a program, of course, you compile it, and you link it, and you build an executable. And that is, that's it. It's just one executable that's going to run. But sometimes what you'd like to do is have that executable, when it's running, just look around.
Get it to sell on their hardware. VMS, VM,
its operating systems under an umbrella, which they call SAA. In any case, the operating systems that will take over are the ones that are licensed to run on many, many people's hardware. And there are really only three of those. There's DOS, there's OS2, which Microsoft plays a central role in both of those, and there's this Unix operating system that's a piece of technology created by AT&T and its laboratories. But there are some fundamental differences between these systems. The OS2 is optimized to run in the desktop environment. That is the office automation, network, graphical, desktop environment, and the practice many applications as we can. And so what we have, in fact, is once we finish a version, we have a very rigid design. We don't give out the source code to allow people to hack around and create funny versions of it. And in fact, we don't run a lot of instruction sets. We pick a specific instruction set, namely the Intel instruction set. And so we allow binary diskettes to be sold. When you go down to ACAT and buy software packages, those are binary diskettes. And that's what you really need for high-volume desktop use. When we talk about Unix as a standard, which it is not yet, in fact, there are more flavors of Unix than all other operating systems put together, even as we resolve those, that division exists, which will happen over the next two or three years. Either AT&T will give up, or this Open Software Foundation will give up. Anyway, somebody's going to give up because it's a total mess right now. It's actually one of the few fights in the computer industry that Microsoft is sort of just standing on the sidelines watching without having to take any particular side. There will be a unified standard. But even as that's unified, the role of that standard is to address a wide variety of architectures, including architectures that'll take over at the mini computer and mainframe level. And so while there's overlap, for example, with the departmental server between the key role of something like Unix and an OS2, the overlap is not that dramatic. The binary standards at the desktop level for high volume will be based on an OS2 type system, whereas the rest of the computer world, which is very proprietary today, will be slowly but surely replaced by Unix-type designs. And in fact, these two systems will take on a lot of common characteristics. In fact, all of the kernel interfaces, which are now embodied in a standard called POSIX, will be available in both of these operating systems. The Mac is in contrast to that. The Mac is nice. In fact, it's something that Microsoft got very involved with, but it's not licensed to other manufacturers. In fact, I've told Apple, geez, they have licensed it to other manufacturers many, many times, despite the fact the only operating system that would take mine away from would be one of Microsoft's operating systems, because I think it's very difficult as time goes on that if it's not licensed to maintain enough volume to really get great software done for that machine. Let me give you a tiny bit of history about the Mac. The computer industry owes a great debt to Xerox for putting together in the early 70s a research laboratory called Palo Alto Research Center Park. Gathered there were many of the great minds. Some of them had come from Stanford Research Institute, SRI, where Doug Engelbart had done his seminal work on group productivity in the mouse and graphics designs. In fact, Bob Melville, one of Engelbart's key aides, went to Xerox Park. A number of new brilliant people, Butler Lamps and Larry Tesler, Alan Kay, Charles Simone. Anyway, they were all there working towards an exciting vision, and that was a vision of a graphics-based computer for individual productivity tied together on a network. And so they developed a lot of the ideas and tools that we use today. All this graphics interface stuff was pioneered by them. Well, their vision missed a few things. They missed the standard microprocessor. They missed the need for a system where it was easy for lots of people to write applications. And in fact, the way the machine was commercialized by Xerox did nothing but lose money for Xerox. Still, it doesn't mean we should thank them. In fact, it means all the more we ought to recognize the incredible research investment that Xerox made there. Well, the early microcomputers I've been talking about, even including this 1981 PC, didn't have the graphics resolution or the performance make it a graphical type of interface. It takes another level up of performance, like the 286 or 386 level of performance. And so our original designs were what we call character-based now. That is, when most applications run, they have just a bunch of ugly-looking characters, modest-based, up on the screen. And in fact, if you get used to that constraint, you sort of forget that it's a terrible constraint. You know, you think, hey, that's the way things are. And a lot of people aren't that open-minded to this new graphical interface. It is such an incredible freedom to get information into to the user that I don't think there's many people inside the industry that disagree that in the next few years, all machines will have that design and all software applications will take advantage of that. And so that's why people really are focused on the graphical type systems. In any case, a lot of people went to Xerox and saw these ideas. I did. Steve Jobs did. Both he and I benefited by hiring some of the people who'd worked there. In our case, our chief applications architect was this person, Charles Simonyi, who did the world's first graphics word processor. In fact, developed some of the ideas for having software teams really enjoy their work and be extremely productive. Apple got Belleville and Tesla, and they went off and influenced the design of a system called Lisa, which was first generation system, big, slow, too expensive, didn't sell. The second time around, the notion was to make it a little less expensive and not to overdo it. And that, in fact, was the design that became the Macintosh. Steve came to me in 1981, talked about the work he was doing there, and we decided that we wanted to get very involved in that. It's kind of an ironic thing in a way, because the only system that we could possibly hurt was our own MS-DOS system. But graphics interface was so exciting to us, and it looked like these guys were really going to build a machine that could do it, that we decided to get very involved. In fact, throughout the project, just as in the case of the IBM project, we had more software people involved than Apple did. We wrote all the initial applications, worked with Apple to debug the software, and in fact, when the machine was introduced in January 1984, Apple's Mac, Write, Mac, Paint, and our applications were all over available. And even to this day, the majority of application software sold on that machine are applications that Microsoft put together. So it has been a great success, and it really is a tribute to this graphics interface that Xerox designed. It's the right way to use a computer. It's not something in any way exclusive to Apple. There's some Apple seems to be confused about that in a minor way. And for some reason, it's devolved upon us to prove that. Are in the process of doing so rather dramatically. In fact, that's something that through this court case will get resolved in the next 3 or 4 months, and then nobody will have to worry about it again. In any case, we got involved with that design knowing that was the direction the industry had to go. And there was a lot to be learned about moving applications into that form. And in fact, writing those applications turns out to be harder than writing normal applications. There's a couple reasons this is so. There's the reason it should be so, which is that if you allow the user at any time to click on anything, if you have this moveless behavior, of course your software is more complicated. It's harder to think through all the interactions in that case than when you have an old-style application that leads the user by the nose and says, now tell me this, now tell me this, now tell me this. When you're looking at the code of that linear interface, you know exactly, okay, we've asked the following 3 questions, and now we're asking the 4th. Whereas in this takeover processor that works in this graphical world, which is sometimes called event-driven, the fact is the person may scroll and shrink the window and open up the footnote window and change the font, change the page size in any sort of random order. And yet you're expected to keep the screen totally up to date based on all those actions. And so it is. There's something that's a little bit harder about that. Then there's the part that's completely unnecessary and we're now eliminating, which is that the way you structure your code and debug code for those environments was initially initially very, very complex. In fact, the original Mac machine was a neat machine for us because it was a machine that only had 128K of memory, and the screen and the system software took away about 40K of that. So there was this immense challenge to try and fit full-blown applications into a small amount of space. And actually, only Bill Atkinson and Microsoft there managed to write applications that ran on that 128K Mac. Part of the beauty of that is it gives you the discipline that even if you get 5, 12K and 1 megabyte and so on, that you're using space efficiently so you get more features into less space. And in fact, your applications run very quickly. There is this notion that over time there'll be so much memory that people can be kind of slobs. That's not true. There will always be a premium for excellent software design. And it's well worth understanding exactly how to write great software because a little bit of performance can make the difference between one application setting a standard and an application that doesn't sell well at all. But we've promoted now the idea of this graphics interface being available on top of MS-DOS to an application we have, a piece of system software we have called Microsoft Windows. And with those two, we decided to simplify things and not have it be an optional element. So we built it into OS 2 through the use of a thing we call the Presentation Manager. That Presentation Manager recently shipped on time, barely, in what we call OS 2 version 1.1. And it's now out there being used as a base of software development. For the next few years, the changes you'll see in the mix of some operating systems by Unify is not all that dramatic. Because these low-end machines, DOS will still be have a larger install base. OS 2 will have replaced about a third of DOS in this time frame. If you look just at the office market, the high end, it'd be more dramatic, particularly if you looked at new sales as opposed to installed base. Unix on a unit volume basis will be larger than it is today, but still fairly small. Although, because of its presence on higher end architectures, that sort of understates its role from a pure sort of dollar point of view. Likewise, I think, and this is, I think, somewhat optimistic, if Apple can continue to do good things, it'll be possible for them to maintain and even grow some of their market share. But if Apple is in a very scary position, having been the first to take the Xerox innovations and offer good commercialization of them, that trick is past. They have to do something to justify a minority standard, a second standard in business. They are the only architecture that got to critical mass, and that was not an easy thing for them to do. During 1985, in fact, a lot of people lost faith. The company lost money, Steve left the company. There were great concerns. And it was only in 1986, with the arrival of the laser writer and page maker and Excel and a number of things in John Sculley's restructuring of the company, that they started to gain enough momentum that the software development community thought, geez, this machine's a critical mass. Yes, we ought to develop software for this machine. And I personally believe that Apple will have to be very creative to preserve their position as a second standard. And I think it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, without a revolutionary breakthrough, for anyone to come along and establish a third standard. Because whenever you think of a third standard, you think, well, whatever feature is good in that standard, why can't that be made available in the current designs? In fact, some of you may have seen the announcement of Steve Jobs, the machine, the next machine, and some of you may even have seen some of my comments about that machine. Basically, it's a great machine. It's a nice machine. You know, putting a microprocessor in a box, putting a bunch of memory in there, putting a mouse and a screen on it, it's a brilliant idea. I see a new one of those every week. But there are some things that are evolutionary type improvements. The use of an optical disk, the use of object-oriented programming, the use of black in this very sort of good-looking way. Of a single processor. All of those things are great things. And in a market where people are willing in many cases to do their own development, a nice machine like that probably very few such markets. In fact, even if you take the university market, if you look at what percentage of it is people wanting to buy a machine for $1,000 or less and do spreadsheets and word processing, that is the vast majority of the university market. Even at a very technically oriented school like this one, there's a lot more of those machines than the super high-end do-it-yourself type machines. And I believe very firmly that those innovations, whether it be optical disks or object-oriented programming, will appear in these Macintosh and DOS architectures in as good or even perhaps a better way than they appear in this new architecture. So I think that it's very hard now to come up with something that would spark a new standard. I believe that some of the areas that we're working in, multimedia, voice, handwriting, massive parallelism, knowledge base, some of those do create an opportunity for a new standard. But those things are much more revolutionary if they can be pulled together properly than simply evolving various elements of the system. There's a lot happening in applications as well as in system software. This is critical because this is where people finally see the benefit. We're really changing personal computers now. We talk about personal computers being used to coordinate groups of people. The standalone PC isn't really a thing of the past. Of course, right now, most machines aren't connected to networks. But in this vision of one on every desk, they will be. They must be in order to provide the information that people need. In fact, our goal here is very simple. When somebody walks into a business, they should sit down, turn on their machine, and they should see on that screen in some nice graphical way the information they're interested in. How did the sales compare to budget? What are the new competitors up to? What's their schedule for that day? What sort of analysis were they playing with before that they might want to go back with and play with? What notes have they taken from meetings that they want to follow up on? That information, all of it, all that business data, business analysis, sales analysis, should literally be a few clicks away for that user simply sitting there looking at that screen. And although, you know, that sounds like a very simple thing, it's going to take a lot of great system software and a lot of great applications to make that come true. The idea of applications working together is this idea of active integration. A simple scenario for this is the idea that when you build your monthly report and put spreadsheet data into it, you don't want to have to manually move that spreadsheet data into that report every time you change the spreadsheet. You'd like to simply create a relationship or a link, as some people say, that causes the machine to automatically move that data around. Now, that's very simple within a single machine, but it gets very complex when you're talking about linking that data across a network. In some cases, the data is not available, or you have to wait to get it updated, things of that nature. And that's what one of the challenges that these object-oriented class protocols will have to address for this active integration. The idea of letting users customize the application's interface is very important. There's no way that we can sit there and design the interface that's optimized for a particular person's mode of operation. A classic example of this is our Macintosh word processor, where everybody complains, you know, why didn't you put this command on the keyboard? Well, we put more commands on the keyboard than, you know, you can possibly imagine. I mean, every key sequence does something, and yet, you know, there are people who say, why didn't you put something on there? Well, what that shows is there's different styles of use, and in the next version of that, we've made it really trivial to assign any of the commands in different keys at an end user level. We also have companies that are thinking of these PCs as critical tools for things like reservation management for an airline or product management for a consumer goods company, or applications that they put together that cooperate with the more horizontal applications using these integration techniques and create mission-critical kind of applications. The reason these are important is partly because it's easier to explain to a company why they should buy a PC for everyone when you have applications that basis. So we're building a complete family of Office applications that run off Macintosh, a Microsoft Windows Presentation Manager, and use these standardized interfaces. In fact, we have created a style guide for the entire software industry to follow when they make choices about user interface, so that various elements are identical in all applications. For example, you always have to have one key to get help in every application. This is a fairly major step forward. In fact, we got less than half as many support calls for our Macintosh applications as our DOS applications. That's our new man word processor. This is a new category of software called presentation software. Our particular product called PowerPoint is available on the Mac today, and will be in the other environments fairly soon. Have you ever seen a miniature view where you have a set of 19 slides, and you're seeing small pictures of them that let you reorder them? You can click on a slide, delete it, click on a slide, drag it. In fact, you can see two presentations at the same time and collate them together and build a specialized presentation. So it's very straightforward to deal with presentations. In fact, you know, you can make slides very easily. You just take your disk and send it to Genographics, and 24 hours later, your slides come back. Or you can actually use a modem and send the data that way. So this is sort of revolutionizing the idea of how you write a bunch of view graphs or how you make up a bunch of slides. There's an interesting competition in the software industry taking place between the sort of reigning standard, which is Lotus's 1-2-3 spreadsheet, and our new spreadsheet, which is based on graphics interface. And it's an exciting competition because we require more powerful hardware, and you know, we're not the standard that everybody knows, and yet we are based on this consistent interface. We have the power and excitement that a graphical interface can bring. And so it's incumbent upon us to get this message out there about this product and make it even easier for people to move from that product to our product. This competition will take a couple years before it's all played out, but we expect, as these graphical machines get more popular, that their standard would fade and Excel would sell much more than 1-2-3 does today. This is actually a screen from the OS2 Presentation Manager, showing here a desktop publishing package called Aldus PageMaker, which is one of the ones that was demonstrated with it when we first shipped it. When I talk about all these performance that we're going to have and how you can compare that to a 3090, you know, high-end machine, you might say that you might think that I'm attacking the mainframe market. We think we're going to replace mainframes. That's not the case at all. First of all, it wouldn't be interesting. In our market, we sell about 10 million machines a year. And so replacing every mainframe in the world would be about one day of sales for the personal computer industry. So it's not like something that would seed our appetite for volume. We need to go after all those desks because there's a bunch of those. And eventually, all those homes. But that's not the key reason. The key reason is that even though our performance will be very high, when you think of data, if you think of, go back to thinking of this as the information age, where all the information is online, you know, world at your fingertips, just, you know, five clicks and any fact ever known is right there on your screen. Well, how's that all going to work? Well, we're not all going to get, you know, terabyte-type disks connected up to our PCs and have all these bits just floating around just in case we're interested. We need a hierarchy of data storage. And so rather than thinking of a performance hierarchy like you might in the past, you should instead think about a hierarchy of data capacity. And this will be at least a three-tier hierarchy. The individual workstation optimized for performance, graphics display, over time, handwriting, voice, motion, sound, is the high-volume machine. And it may or may not have disk storage. For very low cost, there's no reason that it has to. Although today, networks aren't fast enough that really works very well. At the next level up, we have the departmental server, where a group is too complicated to have it run on every individual's workstation. So when you make some of these requests, they're carried on to your, up to your server very efficiently in a simple way. And actually, software is executed on your server that knows how to go out and participate in this wider network and do what's called name service, directory service, security service, all these things that can find resources in the world net. At the organizational level, of course, you need even more data. And that's the role that the mainframe will take on. So think of a mainframe more as a super server over time, and something that will be important. A server is more than just data. It's also electronic mail, communication. And the way you communicate with that server isn't like you think of PC servers today, where every piece of the file has to be brought down to you in case you're interested in it. You'll be able to communicate in a high-level form, including this SQL, which is a type of query language, which will specify exactly which data you want and greatly lower the amount of data traffic down to your machine. Another key thing, all the things I've described are very exciting. In fact, as far as the Office desktop goes, I believe that a fairly natural evolution of today's PC leads us to the machine that would be a valuable tool on every desktop. The application software industry is doing the right things. The chips are getting faster. The graphics are getting better. And really, it will become an invaluable tool. But a lot of what we're doing is still, in a sense, forcing the user to provide all the information. When I ship you a word processor, it's up to you to write the document. Or when I ship you a spreadsheet package, it's up to you to do all that work. And there's another direction that the software industry will be taking, and that is providing you with information, not just code, to deal with the information that you create. For example, imagine a disk that has world maps on it. When you turn it on, you just see a spinning globe, and anything you click on, you zoom in on, and it has a database of nice beaches or other vacation data selection criteria. Or imagine a sports desk with all the facts and information about sports, and depending on how smart you think you are, it quizzes you or teaches you about these various aspects. Now, information just like these can be made much more relevant and interesting through the use of video, high-quality video skills or motion video, and the use of sound. And in fact, in the training area or in the industrial information area, we're already doing this. Boeing took all the manuals on the 747, which, to imagine their size, imagine that they do not fit inside a single 747, and put those onto 10 compact disks and created a form of that information that was far easier to use, far cheaper to update, far easier to track, allowed the user to see only the data relevant to the model that they were interested in. I was superior in every way, and so those paper manuals will no longer be printed. Any type of information that is now in print form, that has any structure at all, is far better in this electronic form. And so we need to create some standards so you can deliver this information and that it can be rich in a video and audio sense. Now, this is exactly the type of thing that Microsoft, through its reasonably central role in the industry, can foster. We can make the investments, we can get the hardware people to do the right thing, we can work with the standards bodies, we can build software tools to let this all happen. And there's some key enabling hardware technologies, specifically the compact disc, which is used as a plastic disc to play audio, allows you to store over 500 million characters of information. That's a factor of 1,000 increase over a floppy disk. And in fact, we could store the Encyclopedia Britannica many times over on a single CD disk. Even with the addition of sound and pictures, you could do a very fine job with all that information. The cost to print a CD is less than the cost to duplicate a floppy disk. And so the pieces are there. They simply have to be assembled into the right form. It's very nice to be piggybacking on the high volume that the consumer audio industry has created in making that device become just software products, but information products that can make these devices, these PCs, far more relevant than simply blank program products. In fact, we recently did something where we went around to a lot of elementary schools and we asked kids, 12 to 15, what they thought the coolest software program would be. And they didn't say word processors or C compilers or anything like that. Virtually every application they talked about were things that required information, something that would teach you, something that would take you out in space, something that would help you choose a career, something that would let you create a fantasy lab. All of these were far more data-driven than program-driven type applications. And in fact, every one of them can be executed in some form using a combination of a compact disk together essentially with today's PC, a little bit of audio capability thrown in, and a little bit of enhancement to the video, and we have what we think of as the multimedia platform. Now, it's a tough bootstrap. I described to you earlier the economics that led to the creation of all this MS-DOS software. We have to recreate that. We have to get the hardware to be low cost, and we have to get a lot of exciting software. But it's hard to start. Who wants to write the software when there's no hardware? And these titles are very expensive. Going out, you know, taking pictures and recording. It's a set of skills that your typical programming company doesn't have. In fact, there's no company that brings in one place all the skills you need to do one of these titles in a very effective fashion. We and several others are trying to develop ourselves so that we can create this type of product. In fact, we have a lot of projects underway. We're spending millions a year to develop this area. And yet, even with my optimism and belief in this, I think it'll take us something like 3 or 4 years before we've created this standard platform. We have millions of machines and hundreds of applications that work in this fashion. When we do, you will think of personal computing as having been transformed. It will be quite a different era than it is today, even though all the technical pieces are there and it's just a matter of putting them all together. There are horizons that go even beyond what I've talked about. Obviously, the notion of the machine having a knowledge base, a semantic understanding of the office and the world we live in is something where there are techniques being developed that will help us move in that direction. Things like voice understanding will make these much more relevant tools. However, I don't think that those advances will move quickly enough to have an influence within the next 5 years. And so our posture with respect to those is to fund a little research, be very much in contact with the universities doing that work, do a few pilot things, but basically watch what everybody's doing while we're pushing forward on these other key technologies. I think it's fair to say that we see this, the idea of a machine becoming an incredible tool everywhere, is something that's inevitable. And the exciting thing for us is to make sure that we stay in the lead and continue to set standards and enjoy the incredible industry that started 14 years ago. Thank you. I spend a lot of time working with them. I haven't actually written a major There was a little portable computer called the Model 100 that I designed for Radio Shack, which is myself and a Japanese guy, Jay Suzuki, wrote all the code that went into that machine. And since then, I've reviewed code, I've designed algorithms. I had an opportunity to do a substantial part of the user interface of our Excel spreadsheet that I get right, actually a single line of code that went to that product. So my role is much more a role of suggesting ideas, seeing if people think, hey, can that be implemented, saying, oh gosh, that'll be easy. Reviewing things to make sure that, you know, the pieces are going to fit together, make sure it moves towards this vision that we're interested in. I do get an opportunity to, you know, look at what's going on in the state of the art. A lot of the time I spend in Japan is in the various labs there, seeing the things they're doing. And I get a lot of time to read various things that are going on. So, you know, a key part of my job is not running the company day to day. In fact, I have a president who works for me who does an excellent job of that. In fact, our organizational structure is that, as far as the business goes, there's only one person who works for me, and that's the president. He does that job. I'm in charge of whatever I want to be, but what that means is business strategy, product strategy, and I spend a high percentage of my time with those architects and the various project teams. And I get more involved in some projects and less involved in some projects, but I do try and stay on top of it. And also by being a user and using every interesting piece of software that comes out and seeing that, hey, there's lots of good ideas out there. Text is one of the techniques that allows you to take a vast quantity of information and let people move through it in a variety of different ways. You know, we've used hypertext. Of course, our help systems that are built into all our products now are essentially hypertext systems. But what we're doing in these compact disk-based products, because of the wealth of information, is much more advanced than a typical hypertext. A simple hypertext has a link, that is, when you point to a keyword in the text, it takes you to the text that that's linked to. And that, for help systems and a certain level of information, that works well. But as you get vast amounts of information, you can't just have these untyped links. It gets, the user gets lost. They don't know where they are. They don't know how to go back. You have to introduce more formal notions of structured linking, types of links that are active based on the profile of the user. In any case, hypertext is sort of a fundamental thing to the user interface to these vast amounts of data that we're providing on CD. It's absolutely true that the industry has to have a balance between standards and innovation. And ideally, what you'd like to do is stick with a certain set of things for a while until it really gets painful, and then, you know, give it up and shift to something else. And, you know, there's this capitalistic market that sort of decides when that happens. As far as 386 goes, you know, code is not that much more portable at the 386 level than it was at other levels. I mean, because there are things about the architecture that creep into the design of programs that make it a little hard to move stuff around. And when you think about how programs now are using the keyboard and the screen and the colors and the input devices, programs are actually more married to the environment than just the instruction set. The instruction set is a small part of it. The graphics subsystem they work on top of has a pervasive effect on the code. Like moving code from Mac to Windows is a fairly tough operation. And instruction sets, you know, Apple is going to have to get off the 68,000 instructions that at some point, you know, maybe 2 years from now, one of these higher performance risk type instruction sets, we have to have a strategy to move from some, you know, 386, 486 type architectures over to a very high performance risk architecture. There'll be very few binary instruction sets that will get longer because you don't want to have to force software stores to carry a lot of these things. In making that transition, we want to provide the same system software layers so that it is, as you say, easier because people have written stuff in high-level language, which most new software is developed in. The operating system itself is in native code, but that's sort of a special case. And even there, we're using an increasing amount of assembly. Software piracy. Early in the industry, you know, it was actually a real problem because the world wasn't big enough. You know, people were stealing the stuff enough that it really made a difference how many programmers I could hire. And actually, I wrote this open letter to hobbyists in 1976. That was sort of the initial start of this debate. You know, at this stage, software piracy. Is a bad thing. It affects all sorts of software companies in terms of what they can invest, not particularly small software companies or people who write products that only appeal to a certain size of user base. You know, it can make the difference between whether they stay in business or they don't stay in business. For companies like us, it's more a matter of, you know, how much can we invest in R&D, how much can we invest in support, things of that nature. Software piracy business world is not a significant problem. Employees of companies in North America are not incented to commit felonies. And so, you know, it's mainly a matter of laziness. And by the time we get the stuff, all the software sitting in a library on the network where you can just call it up with a command and automatically the right billing takes place, you know, that laziness thing will be eliminated as a problem. There are other markets geographically and different types of markets where you get software piracy, and that's too bad.